Hello and welcome. I'm Kiran Kapoor. This week we reach B in our occasional series of A Podcaster's Guide to Marketing Acronyms.
The Podcaster's Guide to Marketing Acronyms.
This week we're going to look at the BCG matrix, which is all about portfolios of products, and we're going to consider some definitions that marketers just throw around casually. B2B, B2C, and a couple of others, B2E and B2G.
The Podcaster's Guide to Marketing Acronyms.
Let's start with those. So the first B in all of those is always business. Though technically organisation would be a better term, because we could well be in the realms of charities, not-for-profits, social enterprises, as well as profit-making businesses. B2C is where most people think of marketing. We all tend to think of big advertising campaigns as being the business talking to the consumer. That's partly the fault of marketing commentators, because they tend to talk about high profile business to consumer ads, and also marketing tutors such as me, because we tend to use examples that people can quickly understand. And it's much easier to mention Coca-Cola than something more technical. So B2C can encompass those really big campaigns.
Whole Earth Peanut Butter, official supplier of lifts, splits, nice. Strains, heaves, hoes, keep going, Helen. Spins, and hopefully a fair few wins. So come on, Team GB, we're with you the whole way.
Or some smaller campaigns, smaller companies perhaps using something like Facebook to reach their target audience. B2B is business to business. Now, there's quite a lot of argument amongst marketers about whether it's actually different marketing B2B as marketing B2C. But the main difference is the number of people involved in making the buying decision. Here is David Lewis from Mimetic Communications to explain.
From a strategic point of view, you would map out, you know, who are the key decision makers and where do you need to make that influence. I mean, usually what we're trying to do is reach the kind of higher up people who are making those strategic decisions, and then that would be supported by the kind of very technical detail. But what most companies that we work with want to do, they need to kind of influence the people at the top, maybe at the top of the department, who don't necessarily know the technical stuff, but they know they need to know it. So, you know, artificial intelligence is a very good example. A lot of organizations in, you know, in energy, in life sciences, in those kind of industries, they know this is changing their industry. They know they need to do something about it, but they themselves are not artificial intelligence experts. So they need to understand how this hugely technical thing can benefit their organization. And it's, you know, it's not a case of saying AI is great, because quite clearly AI isn't always great. There's been some pretty spectacular failures and some pretty spectacular successes. So, you know, what is it that makes it a success for a, you know, for that kind of level of decision maker, and how can you kind of influence those kind of decisions?
The next B we had was B2E, and this is business to employee, but it's more usually now described as internal communications, and it is the business or the organisation wanting to think about how they market and give communications to their internal staff and perhaps some of their closest stakeholders. And then the final one was B2G, and this is business to government, sometimes called marketing public affairs, sometimes viewed as lobbying. And we'll have an expert on a future show to explain this incredibly complex area. And next we're going to look at the BCG matrix, that's the Boston Consulting Group matrix, with Charles Nixon. Everybody knows the BCG matrix. You're going to have to think of another 2x2 box. People remember it because it has pictures. So it has a question mark, a star, a cow, and a dog. Here's Charles Nixon to explain.
Its main benefit is the fact that it shows that at any one time, the company needs to have what we describe as a portfolio, but a series of products or services that are at different stages in their life cycle. The matrix is made up of two axes, one of which is a relative market share, and it's important to understand that it's relative to your competition, and market growth in terms of the growth rate of the markets. The top right axis, as it tends to be seen, is where new products enter. They are low in market share relative to their competition. But because they are entering, the assumption is that there is a high growth in the market. So they're in the top quadrant for market growth. They are known as problem childs or question marks because they have not yet established their presence in the marketplace and may indeed not do so, dependent on the marketing actions taken by the company. Should those company actions be good and drives the market penetration of the product or service, they move into the next quadrant, which is known as the star category. So this is an organization that now has good products with good market share in a rapidly growing market. As time goes by, that relative growth rate, because we're looking at several sets of products here, will decline, but the market share may well stay the same relative to its competition, or indeed maybe even increase. The result of which is we move into the third quadrant, which is what everyone knows as the cash cow. The cash cow is a point at which you have a relatively less attractive marketplace in terms of market growth, but you have high dominance of that marketplace, and therefore you're able to yield a considerable amount of profit from that or that marketplace. As time goes on again and companies manage their portfolios, they may well take their foot off the marketing accelerator, the result of which is the product will decline in terms of market share in a marketplace which is, relatively speaking, slower growth than the other opportunities that the product that the company has, and therefore it moves into the final phase, which is the bottom right-hand module quadrant, which is therefore the dog point at which a product should be exited out of the portfolio. There are some issues about it, but the most important aspect, I think, is to realise that there is need to have a balanced portfolio for the long-term survivability of an organisation.
Okay, so we sort of come in, and I think one of the problems with the BCG is that you almost feel like it's just a, this is the way it goes. So you come in as a question mark, you become a star, it becomes a cash cow, it becomes a dog. But that, in real life, it doesn't work like that, does it?
In real life, it can go into all sorts of different ways because the speed at which market changes is not defined. So some products can arrive on the scene, become astronomically successful very, very quickly and then die. And indeed, some products are even designed to go through this process, which we would otherwise perhaps see as a product life cycle very, very quickly. Some products, you're quite right, will enter the marketplace, be a complete failure and rapidly become a dog. They fail to gain traction in the marketplace. The market declines very rapidly because it was a something that was very short-lived, and the product exits very quickly, or should exit very quickly. So yes, the answer is it doesn't work as a regimented routine of all four quadrants for every product.
And if, as a company, finds that they've got a dog product, do they automatically want to get rid of it?
There's an interesting argument here, and indeed, all of the quadrants have their own strategies and tactics. In the dog scenario, the idea is that you get rid of the product because it is wasting resources. You should be better off spending those resources, time, manpower, assets, in developing either new products or managing existing more remunerative products. However, there is a possibility, of course, that the product in the marketplace still has a significant legacy out there and is worthwhile maintaining. You could see that certain products, maybe things like Bovril, or indeed things which I don't know if you can still get it, but it used to be around for quite a very long period of time, things like Camp Coffee, which was a liquid coffee, were maintained because there was a certain amount of residual benefit to be had. These products if they are fast moving consumer goods, tend to be still known in the marketplace without actually any promotion. It's only the requirement is to actually place it on the shelf, and therefore they could still be value in maintaining the brand and indeed in gaining some income from them. But generally speaking, I would counsel that most dogs should be got rid of because they are distracting for the company. I have yet to find a company that has a well-pruned product list. Nearly all companies that I've come across have got large legacy lists of products and services which they are still servicing. And that is expensive.
Yes, sometimes you can keep a dog product because it's what the customer sort of expects. We had a student that worked for an industrial chemical company, and I mean, they were producing chemicals that I didn't understand and really didn't want to. But they also kept some fairly sort of basic stuff around just because customers would finish off an order going, oh yeah, and while we're there, could we have a couple of canisters of, I don't know, CO2? I'm making this up.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, so it would just finish off an order and customers expected it. And it was more convenient to offer it to the customer than not. But as you say, it does require, that still requires inventory. It still requires having the product in stock and so on.
Yes. And in that scenario, if the customer wants the product, then the customer should pay for it. And if you are going to have inventory taking up room in the warehouse, then that should be covered as a cost. As long as it is, there's no problem in keeping the product around.
Each box had its own sort of strategies and things you needed to do. So let's go back up to the top one, the sort of the question mark. What are my strategies if I've got a question mark product or service?
Well, here the main aspect is awareness. You want the marketplace to become aware that your product now exists and has been designed to satisfy a need that you've identified or indeed is known in the marketplace. The classic example perhaps is that, you know, if we take something such as mobile phones, come 2008, an organization like Apple introduces a smartphone. You've got to show people exactly what a smartphone is, how it's used, and why it should replace the existing either analog or digital phones, which were feature phones. So a lot of market awareness has to be raised. So that's usually high profile advertising and is probably fairly selective distribution. What you would normally see at the early adopters phase of the product lifecycle strategies.
And so that's the question mark box. So we move on to the next one, which is the sort of star box.
So in star, here is gaining as much market share as possible. We've obviously tried to achieve that by raising awareness and distribution, but now we're trying to get to a point at which we can bring the costs down. We're trying to still pay off the costs of developing the market entry and obviously the development of the product or service. So here we're looking at pricing, we're looking at competitive featuring, so as to try and maintain our market share, but at the same time trying to get sufficient volume to reduce our unit costs. The issue here you've got to bear in mind is that this is a rapidly growing marketplace, and therefore the product needs to be responsive. The more the product is sold, the lower the unit cost of production or delivery. And what we're trying to do is to bring us to a profitable situation as rapidly as possible here, and to gain as much market dominance so that when the marketplace becomes perhaps less attractive compared to other markets that the company might get into, we are able to milk the product in the next stage, which is the cash cow.
Okay, so that brings us neatly onto the cash cow. And I think there's always the temptation of going, right, this product is now going to keep raking in the money, so we can just sort of leave it there and concentrate on the next star. But clearly, again, in real life, it doesn't work like that.
You don't want it necessarily to work like that because you want this stage to be as long as possible, because this is what generates the cash for the company. This is what pays the wages, this is what pays the R&D costs for the next generation of products. And so this phase is probably the most important for organizations. They want long cash phases. Here again, we're obviously reducing costs because we're maintaining high levels of volume. We don't necessarily have to spend as much money in terms of raising awareness and understanding in the marketplace, but we do have to continue to think about our competitive positioning. So this is possibly where pricing becomes more important. Distribution becomes very important because we need to get as much coverage in the marketplace as possible. And we want to still maintain a brand position which is different from all the competitors which will have tried to get into the marketplace. If we are the market leader, we need to continue to make that point with small, probably, levels of innovation. But there will be continuous levels of increment in terms of the way in which the product is developed.
Fantastic, Charles Nixon. Thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure.
And that's it for this week's show. Thank you for listening. The big B that we haven't covered this week is brand. And we'll look at that in a lot of detail another week.